Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to London and find out whether the 4 days of riots and looting are about class warfare, criminal opportunism, or both. Caroline Frost, who is an editor with the Huffington Post UK and was previously a producer with BBC News, joins us for an update on the riots that appear to have moved today from London to the north, although last night her neighbourhood in Ealing was looted. Then we will look into the sacking of Syria's Minister of Defence and the lecture given to the Assad dictatorship by Turkey's foreign minister to see whether there are cracks in this increasingly isolated regime. Radwan Ziyadeh, who is the founder and director of the Damascus Centre for Human Rights Studies, joins us to discuss the mounting death toll of unarmed Syrian citizens trying to free themselves from their murderous government. Then finally, we will speak with John Judas, who is a senior editor with the New Republic and has been covering Mitt Romney in New Hampshire. We will talk about the leading Republican contender for president and John Judas's latest essay in the New Republic, Liberals' Strange Retreat on Government Spending. Joining us now from London is Caroline Frost, who is an editor at the Huffington Post UK edition. Previously, she worked as a producer for BBC News. Welcome to Background Briefing, Caroline Frost.
Hello, Ian.
And in your own neighbourhood last night, you experienced looting. But let's just begin with today. It seems that what happened today with the deployment of some 16,000 police on the streets of London, the rioters moved north.
That's right, Ian. What we had last night was approximately 6,000 police on the streets of London, which obviously proved insufficient to cope with this just huge surge of what had amounted to lawlessness and anarchy on the streets. And so today we had the Prime Minister come home, we had Boris Johnson, the London Mayor, walking around the streets and realising the state of basically what they've had to really deal with. And they've made this huge push forward. It's 16,000 police. All police leave for the Metropolitan Force has been cancelled, and they've also taken in reinforcements from around the country. And of course, now what's happened, almost ironically, is that all the groups of people have moved north, and it's turned into violence on the streets of Manchester tonight and also Bristol.
And does that suggest some kind of organisation and coordination?
Well, what they seem to be suggesting, depending on who you listen to and watch on the news, is that either it's a very organised system where people are surging forward, and there's also lots of imitation replica activity where people in Bristol and Manchester have been watching what's been going on in London and have turned to their BlackBerries and started organising themselves in a sort of mimicry crime wave.
So the question that I posed in the opening, is this class warfare or criminal opportunism or both?
I think it's absolutely a cauldron of both. I think that using the word class war becomes very difficult to really specify because there are so many different tranches of class in Britain as there are in America, I'm sure, in terms of you have immigrants who come over, work hard and build businesses up from scratch, fourth generation immigrants who are now wouldn't class themselves as working class by any means, have more money than many people who don't consider themselves working class. I certainly think a huge wave of opportunity grabbing has come, certainly in the second and third day, where people have just taken to the streets and it's just ridiculous. I mean, the looting has gone on. What's really broken my heart is hearing much more cynical gestures. For example, there were reports that while various gangs were looting places like Ealing and Croydon and Clapham, much better dressed, much more apparently genteel women and young girls were driving up in cars and shouting out, almost by an organised move, that various boutiques and clothes shops were being targeted. It was as though they'd thought, right, we've heard there's violence, let's get down there and see what we've got. I mean, that's not class warfare, that's just absolute blatant opportunism. I also saw today on the streets in the centre of London, I don't know what you think of this, coming home from work, we were told to leave work early at 3 o'clock to get home safely. And what I saw was a stand being put up for the first time on the street by the tube station, somebody offering discount paintball. I mean, what do you think of that?
Well, tell me then, Caroline Frost, what happened in your neighbourhood? Because I used to work at the BBC's Ealing studio there, and it's a nice neighbourhood, but I take
Absolutely.
It that some of your neighbourhood shops like florists were looted. I mean, I don't see the political statement in that.
Sure, the little shopkeepers were targeted. As you say, you've been here. It's words like leafy, genteel, tranquil are all banded around to describe Ealing. So it's a nice little pocket in West London on the tube line. And maybe the tube line was key to its access to various groups of people who came here last night. I'd actually got home. I live in a street just around the corner from a green, which is next to the tube station, where apparently 200 people converged, set fire in the middle of the park, which is very sad because it's all beautifully landscaped recently, lots of council investment to make a nice place for recreation, and instead it just became a big burning mass. And along all one side of the park, such things as restaurants, cafes, tea bars, newsagents, tiny shopping supermarkets, we're talking about a sort of 50-year-old pharmacy, which is very, very sweet, and it isn't a chain shop by any means, not one of these big budget chain stores. All windows this morning systematically smashed in, one after another along the row, and apparently the road round the corner from there, every single car had its front windscreen smashed in, which again is just pointless. I mean, presumably nothing being taken from inside the cars, just vandalism.
So again, I'm speaking with Caroline Frost, who's an editor at the Huffington Post UK edition. And in London proper, though, it does seem that the Armanis and the Adidases and the Nike stores and the Curry stores, which is where the electronics, TVs and VCRs are sold, they seem to have been targeted.
Absolutely. I mean, this is what we've all been saying. If this is a BlackBerry war, if this is a new guerrilla war of social media, what we saw 2 or 3 months ago in Egypt was that a revolution was sparked using such methods of communication between people, and what they achieved was the change of regime and hopefully a new democracy and lasting peace. What we've seen in England by the same method is a lasting bunch of plasma television screens being misplaced and put into people's living rooms. I mean, if that's what we're aiming for, it's a pretty pathetic end. And it's a very disastrous means, nothing justifying it at all. Ridiculous.
But is there an element, though, in amongst the young that would tie into an analogy with the Arab Spring? Because what the echo in the Arab Spring is the young feel their futures were stolen by these kleptocratic regimes. And I just read a piece by Stephen Brewer in the Huffington Post UK edition. He's a blogger, saying London riots, Britain's social elastic is snapping back in Cameron's face. And he talks about the society is falling apart, young people running amok. They don't give a damn about getting arrested. What's a criminal record when you don't have any future anyway? And then he goes on to talk about how difficult it is now that all the opportunities for young people have been slashed in these austerity measures, whereas university educations are out of reach and youth clubs are being shut down and EMA terminated and jobs cuts. So give us a sense of whether or not there is some element of rage amongst the young at the lack of opportunity.
Absolutely. I mean, these people are ripe for the picking by bad, more senior elements of society. It really is very, very sad to watch a society. I mean, presumably, we're told we're crawling out of a recession, and all these huge, massive cuts on society that do end up affecting the little man. For example, though, in fact, sadly as well, it's those tiny shopkeepers that lost out so massively last night that are also a victim of that. The chain stores, the really big ones, will weather these climbs, I know. But what you get is a group of people, especially somewhere like Tottenham, which was where all the riots kick-started on Saturday night after a protest, what started as a peaceful protest because a man was shot by the police on Thursday night. And there was a protest about this in Tottenham. And obviously that tapped in then into a huge cauldron of scissoring unrest, which has just expanded and expanded. But you're absolutely right. In Tottenham, for example, youth centres have been closed down. I mean, the money has got to come from somewhere when huge cuts are made in society like this. So one after another, they've seen for places to go, things to do, recreation, purpose, all these things that perhaps some of us take for granted are suddenly just taken off the street. Even if people don't go to youth clubs, at least there's an awareness that there's a community there, there's somebody responsible, somebody who cares. And for all of those things to be taken away, suddenly that's a huge number of people who are incredibly disenfranchised, probably just very frustrated, lacking methods of articulacy, outlet, focus, just, as I say, all the things that I'm sure you and I probably take for granted, really, because I live in a nicer part of town and have better people around me. And so it can only be a matter of time. What do they do? I don't know. I don't have the answers to that. And at the moment, of course, what happens then is there's this huge incentive, because the riots happened in the same place in 1985, and what happened after that was that suddenly there was a surge of interest, investment, community participation and government support. And suddenly Tottenham found itself with a brand new swimming pool, municipally intended. And so there's almost an argument that suddenly the loudest will get some grease, the people that spark up the most protest, whichever way it takes, will be in some way a beneficiary. It's an incredibly cynical way to look at it, but that's what happens retrospectively. And so you could almost justify, at least see where they're coming from and why they're doing what they're doing, even if that isn't their purpose on a nightfall, when what they really want is just to have the nice trainers that they see somebody else having and the nice television. I mean, poverty is obviously a huge problem, but inequality is just a match torch.
Well, I saw Caroline Frost on the BBC interviews with a couple of young women in Clapham who were taking part in the rioting and the burning. And they said, when they asked what motivated them, they said, well, we're going to show the rich that we're not afraid, and we're not afraid of them, and we can do what we want. That's exactly the quote. Then there was a clip of a couple of young people running away from Macquarie's carrying a VCR, and the reporter said, well, are you proud of what you're doing? And they said, no, we pay our taxes, and now we're getting some taxes back. So, I mean, it's not, this is anecdotal, and it's not exactly politically profound.
It's a fair picture. It's a snapshot of what is going on. And those are the articulate ones that aren't particularly violent-minded. I mean, you've got to remember there are a lot of people that have gone out looking for a fight, equally, with no sense of ideology or community protest in sight, in their mind's eye. So you've got all these different people. I mean, who knows? There could be people going out looking for a fight who then who get attached to an agenda that they had no idea was there in the first place, and suddenly they're all part of a big community protest. And, of course, what that does deeply cheapens the message and defaces the nature of peaceful protest as we know it and hold it dear in this country. I mean, that's the real tragedy for me, is watching that happen before my eyes and seeing it just sort of desensitized and turned into just a rabble rule, a mob rule. It's like something turning into something like, I don't know, Lord of the Flies, you know, just we can be lawless and we have impunity because we are young and there is very little that the law can do. And certainly after two nights of watching it being seen to be so ineffective, what is the point of all these laws if they are basically unenforceable?
Well, Caroline Frost, again, an editor at the Huffington Post UK's edition, we're talking about the riots that have taken place over the last 4 days and last night in her own neighbourhood, and today largely moved to the north, to Manchester and Bristol. But there still seems to me to be a political element here, and nobody's trying to justify lawlessness place some political overlay on lawless activity. However, the Prime Minister himself had to come back from a vacation in Europe, or most of them are on vacations. Of Cameron and Clegg's cabinet, both of those two are multimillionaires, there are 16 multimillionaires in the cabinet.
And certainly it's done them no favours to all be coming back belatedly, sporting suntans, to deal with a crisis that has been deeply embedded inequality in the country. You're right, symbolically, it's shoddy politically, all of them, right across the board. I mean, there was nobody from the government available to comment on the riots last night. Effectively, all of them were on planes, just whizzing back, especially poor David Cameron, in a terrible case of bad timing, was on holiday in Tuscany, which is known for its sort of middle-class aspirational qualities, Tuscany of all places, and to have to be coming back, sporting a suntan, talking to the cabinet, talking to the Met Police, and then addressing the media. he's probably had better mornings, I'm sure. And certainly, Tony Blair said when he was Prime Minister, he vowed to be tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime. I would say the former of those two is much easier than the latter. And to be tough on the forces of crime is to take on a huge wealth of unemployment, a chasm between rich and poor, which is ever widening in this country. And what we're seeing now is not an excusable outlet for it, but certainly one symptom of a rotten core of, as I say, inequality and chasm between rich and poor.
But surely on top of that, though, Caroline, on top of the disparity in wealth with the 16 members of the cabinet being multimillionaires, these are the very people that are instigating austerity measures where there may be some hypocrisy of going on an Italian vacation while the average English worker is downsized. And I'm wondering, because our government just put through an austerity package as a result of the debt being held hostage, mm-hmm. and that this was the deal, and everybody's kind of disgusted with it. But the long and the short of it is that the lesson in England, which many economists are pointing to, is that when you have a recession, the worst thing you can do is impose austerity measures. It'll just deepen the recession, and economists are now arguing that the same thing will happen here in the United States. So how does the austerity measures connect? Do they connect with these riots?
Certainly. As I say, because what happens is the ripple-down effect. For every pound that is being moved around to try and dig the country out of the recession, the pennies may look insignificant on paper, but they are the pennies that are the difference between a community centre running for four nights a week and perhaps two nights a week in somewhere like Tottenham or Hackney or Croydon, which are areas of poverty in London. And so it would be impossible to quantify two jobs per community centre per night closed, if you see what I mean. But obviously there is an algorithm that is true. Somewhere on that spectrum is cause and result, because this is what we're seeing. We're seeing families. I mean, we have, for every person who says it's the government's fault for being away and not running the country properly, there's somebody else who pops up and said today, caused an absolute outcry by saying it's obviously the problem of single mothers having too many children and not being in a position to look after them properly. And why are these children out on the streets? If I were a mother and my son walked home with a TV in his hand, I'd clip him around the end and send him to a police cell. But I'm sure that that's easier said than done when you are a single mother struggling to cope. And again, you turn on the TV and what you see is David Cameron in his nice suit coming back from Tuscany with his multimillionaire wife and his nice children and claiming to care about the problems that you turn around and you see in your tower blocking in Tottenham. Yes, of course they're related. Inequality breeds deep, deep resentment. We see this all over the world, don't we? I mean, in places like Somalia, you get such places of inequality and it leads to terrorist cells. You get it here and it leads to what we've seen today. So absolutely, deep-rooted problem. I don't claim to have any answers, and I would welcome somebody wiping the page completely bare and starting again from scratch. Idealistic of mine, I know.
Well, that's a good note to end on, and I appreciate you staying up so late, Caroline, to join us.
It's good to talk about it. It has been very, very shocking, and there are so many things to think about, because obviously personally it feels like an invasion, and then intellectually you rationalise that nobody really wants to be doing that with their time, breaking into shops. How desperate would you have to be when, as the blogger on the Huffington Post UK said, there is just nothing to lose. I mean, I would rather have things to lose myself. So lots to think about.
Thank you again for joining us, Caroline Frost.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking to Caroline Frost, who's in London. She's an editor with Huffington Post UK edition, and previously she worked as a producer for BBC News. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his forthcoming book, From Modernization to Globalization, the United States, the Middle East, and the World Economy in the 20th Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly there have been some serious, first of all, there's a growing isolation and global isolation of the Assad regime, but those that still have connections, like the neighbors next door to the north, Turkey, who seem to have played the most constructive role so far, while the United States seem to be keeping a distance for reasons which we could get into, which somewhat mystify me. But the long and the short of it is the Syrian, the Turkish foreign minister apparently gave Assad a dressing down, and the three Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, pulled their ambassadors, and the Saudis were quite outspoken in talking about the brutality of this regime. Are there some cracks developing here, do you think?
First of all, I really have to be very cynical about when the Saudis start talking about the brutality of a regime or their lust for democracy. The outside support, I mean, the ramping up of the violence has been really extraordinary in the last 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, right now we're in the midst of Ramadan, and right now there is a campaign going on to try to put down the demonstrations and protests that are taking place. Particularly, Hama appears to be over. Deir ez-Zor is ongoing. Deir ez-Zor is a provincial town way to the east of Syria. So the level of violence has just gotten to be absolutely extraordinary in the most recent period. And this is very likely the reason why that the Turks, the Saudis, and various other people as well have not been able to sit on their hands.
So the other indicator, perhaps, of some splits within the Assad regime was the recent firing of the defense minister, who is an Alawite, and this is the Alawite regime. That's the Assads and their security people all come from that minority tribe of about 15% of the population. They hold most of the power and enforce they're the enforcers of the regime. He quit, and he was replaced by a Christian general. Some speculation out there suggests that maybe some of the Alawites are trying to break with the regime, because what the regime, I think, is telling the minorities, whether they be Alawites and Christians, they're saying, if you don't stick with us and we go under, the Sunni majority will slaughter us all. So your fate is tied to ours. I mean, that's the subtext of the Assad regime's message, isn't it?
Yes, and it has been for quite a while. The Assad regime has fundamentally said, look, you know, it's us or one of two things, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood on the one hand or sectarian violence on the other hand. That being said, I would not read an extraordinary amount into this sacking in terms of either splits within the community or what have you, for a couple of reasons. Number one, from the very beginning, Alawites have come out against the repression that the Assad regime has done. I mean, Assad rules not only as a minority, but also in terms of tribal and clan loyalties as well. And not every member of the Alawite community is a member of Assad's clan or is a member of Assad's community, which he's relied on quite a bit. The other thing is that's important is that sectarian identity is not necessarily coextensive with political identity. They overlap for sure. But on the other hand, it's sectarian identity is certainly not destiny. So we have a splitting that has taken place within the community very likely, very possibly. But on the other hand, we also have a situation in which the Assad regime is still extremely has a lot of resources upon which to draw.
So the Assad regime's main resource in terms of repression seems to be the younger brother Maher, right? He first of all has the best equipped and the most loyal regime, both in the military, the brigade that he controls, and also the Republican Guards. But he also has this group called the Ghosts. They're often referred to as ninjas. Can you describe their activities?
Right. This is the so-called Ashba, which literally translates from the Arabic as ghosts. They're the hired thugs. We've seen them in every one of these protests that have taken place throughout the Middle East. For example, in Egypt, you had what they call the Baltagia, hatchet men, literally, who work with security forces. It's these people who are being used as the cutting edge of the state violence against the population. But they're not the only ones as well. For example, probably your listeners remember the case of Hamza al-Khatib, the young boy who was returned, his body was returned, he was picked up in a demonstration, kept for a couple of days, his body was returned to his parents in a mutilated state. That was Air Force intelligence. Hafez al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father, was in Air Force, came out of the Air Force, and the Air Force intelligence has its particular reputation for violence as well. So there are these aspects of the regime that are under the control, not only direct control of the Assad family, but under the control, for example, of, like the Ashbah, people from his from the area from which he came, which is around the Latakia region of Syria.
So, again, I'm speaking with James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA, a specialist on Syria. We're talking about possible cracks in the Syrian regime that's becoming more and more isolated, with condemnation from some of its Arab neighbors and previous supporters, like the Saudis and the Gulf states and Kuwait. But on the other hand, the Iranians are apparently not. I understand they've given up to $6 billion in credit to prop up this regime, and also they've sent in the Bashish militia and Revolutionary Guard Corps to crack heads, since they've had some practice putting down the Green Revolution in Iran. So what's this? Where do we stand on sanctions? Because obviously military intervention has never been on the table. You could excuse the Obama administration for having its hands full and not wanting to get anywhere near any more intervention. But on the other hand, I think cynically what's happening here is that because of the press blackout, the American people are not seeing the true nature of the brutality of this regime. And that's fine with the administration. They just don't want to bother with this one. But at some point or other, the rest of the world's outrage is growing. And I don't understand why, if we have sanctions against the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is the regime that runs Iran that we hate so much, and they're trying to prop up Assad, you'd think that the U.S. Would think, well, maybe we should be happy to see the end of Assad.
Well, we do have sanctions against the regime. We have sanctions against Bashar and against his brother Maher and a whole bunch of other people as well. And we also have sanctions, by the way, against the Iranian groupings within Syria that are theoretically, again, we don't really know for sure, that are more than theoretically very likely to be perpetrating either the violence or to be at least helping the Syrian state in maintaining control. But you have to understand that American policy is long-term in terms of Syria. And we have not come out against Bashar al-Assad for a number of reasons. It's a very, very rough neighborhood that he's in. Syria's borders are next to Turkey's, are next to Iraq's, are next to Israel, et cetera, et cetera. The United States does not want to see a fragmentation of this regime. It does not want to see the sectarian violence that it thinks will happen if Bashar al-Assad falls. It doesn't want to see that spill over into, for example, Lebanon. It doesn't want to see ethnic violence between Arabs and Kurds, for example, spilling over into either Iraq or into Turkey. And frankly, Bashar al-Assad has been very, very good about keeping that border quiet between Israel and Syria. There is no peace treaty, of course, between the two. But then again, there hasn't been active hostilities. And if your listeners remember back a couple of months when Palestinians, unarmed Palestinians, went to the border and several were killed in a demonstration, that was probably a show by the Syrian government of what could possibly happen should this regime fall.
So that was their way to tell the Israelis that we can make life miserable for you. And the Israelis have also taken the American line, which is a hands-off approach, it would seem.
Right.
But that seems to be...
There was this wonderful incident of, or story of Michael Oren, who is the Israeli ambassador to the United States, having to deny that he was going around to various embassies in the United States, saying that Israel wants the regime to stay in power. He had to deny that. So, again, it's one of those things. Syria so far has been very, ironically, has been very, very good for Israel, ironically in the sense that it is the head of the resistance camp, theoretically, in the Arab world. But on the other hand, has kept that border very, very quiet for the Israelis.
But that's, James Galvin, the Turks have clearly have gone beyond our kind of, realpolitik calculus that the devil we know is better than the devil we don't know. It seems like they're thinking of a post-Assad regime. And I guess, one could be sympathetic to some of the minorities in Syria, seeing what happened next door in Iraq. But then, you can blame George W. Bush for that, surely. I mean, nobody wants to break up Syria. They just want to free it from this murderous government.
Right, but again, this is the dictator spin. I mean, we've heard this with Hosni Mubarak. We've heard this with Ali Abdullah Saleh. Everybody says the same thing. After me, the deluge. After me, what's going to happen is either an Islamist takeover or this is going to be a bust-up. Now, American policy is such that we certainly do not want either one to take place. And the United States is actually following the same sort of policies that it's followed pretty much everywhere else. I mean, for example, if you look at Bahrain, for example, in which a minority government like Syria, a minority government rules over a majority. In this case, in the case of Bahrain, it's a minority Sunni government ruling over a majority Shi'i government, which means that, of course, the United States fears Iranian influence. So therefore, when Saudi Arabia moved into Bahrain and committed all sorts of atrocities in Bahrain, the United States didn't let out a murmur.
So what then is the likely scenario here, do you think, James Galvin? Because I don't think in spite of our realpolitik reluctance to look beyond this regime, and I can't imagine why we think that it's worth holding on to this regime. The rest of the world seems to be moving inexorably, more sanctions. They're starting to cut off their oil supply. It would seem that once you break the patronage lock that the Assad clan have over the bazaars and the middle class in Damascus, and if the Christians, for example, have some kind of assurances that they're not going to end up like the Iraqi Christians, I would think that you could have a peaceful transition.
I think we're way beyond the idea of a peaceful transition at this point. The other thing, though, is
so what's going to happen then if he falls? Just give us the grim scenario.
Well, I mean, there are several things. One thing is in the assumption that, for example, where the Christians will come down. This regime has lasted for 40 years, Hafez al-Assad and Bashar al-Assad, simply because it did an extraordinarily good job, not only of concentrating immediate power into its own hands, but also allowing a number of other groupings, not just Alawites, to expand their economic base and patronage and so on and so forth. They brought in, for example, Christian merchant families, mostly from Damascus, but also from Aleppo, who don't want to see the regime go. So you have ties between Alawites and Christians, and it's not just the minority thing. They both benefit from those ties. As far as what outsiders can do or will do, they've pretty much reached the limits of what they can and will do. I mean, you can have harsh words for Bashar al-Assad, you could have sanctions on Bashar al-Assad, but you have to remember, number one, that the Iranians certainly like this regime, want to maintain this regime, and will do whatever is necessary in order to keep this regime in power, and that the rest of the world is extraordinarily ambivalent. So what I think everybody is hoping for is that if it has to be done dirty, in other words, if the regime has to stay in power by committing those atrocious acts of violence that it has been committing for the last particularly month, you know, hopefully it'll be over quickly and they'll be able to put down this rebellion. That's what I think everybody is hoping for.
Well, that is a very disturbing and uncomfortable truth, if that is indeed the true behind-the-scenes attitude that these governments have, that are all expressing outrage.
Unfortunately, I think that we don't know what's going on in the councils of government. As I said before, the Americans have pretty much played out a very specific set of scenarios in terms of how it wants to deal with the various Arab uprisings that have taken place since Tunisia. The Saudis are certainly not somebody that you should bank on for supporting democratic change anywhere in the Middle East or in the Arab world in particular. And the idea that there's anything further that can be done in terms of American outrage or European outrage or even the neighbors themselves, it's probably not going to do a whole hell of a lot. This regime has seized its back against the wall, and it has not hesitated in the past from using the most extraordinary means of violence in order to protect itself.
Well, I guess there's a part of me that just finds that hard to accept, James Galvin, even though this is a perfectly reasonable and rational argument, I can't see it how at the end of the day such a hideous clan could preside over a seething population. It's the same situation in Iran. At the end of the day, I still think the Revolutionary Guard Corps regime will crumble because, as the opposition says, we are the burning embers beneath the ashes. And if you, with such sheer brutality, you put down the aspirations of these people, the majority of the people in a country, that doesn't mean the aspirations go away.
No, you're absolutely right. And in this season in particular of the Arab uprisings, all bets are off. But this regime has maintained itself in power for a very long period of time, and Arab autocracies in general have maintained themselves in power for a very long period of time. What we're seeing now is a level of brutality that we don't normally experience. But if you look at Gaddafi's Libya, for example, or the Saudi state, or any of these other places in the Middle East, that violence is there right below the surface. Mm-hmm. And the world really has not either objected to it or done anything about it until until January, actually, of this year.
Well, I thank you for joining us, James Galvin. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his forthcoming book, From Modernization to Globalization, The United States, the Middle East, and the World Economy in the 20th Century. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back, joined by the New Republic's John Judas.
زخ رصاص على الناس العزل يا حيف واطفال بعمر الورد اعتقلن كيف زخ رصاص
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is John Judas, who's a senior editor at The New Republic. His books include The Paradox of American Democracy, Elite Special Interest in the Betrayal of Public Trust, William F. Buckley, Patron Saint of the Conservatives, and Grand Illusion, Critics and Champions of the American Century. He's been covering Mitt Romney's campaign in New Hampshire and has written a piece in the New Republic, Liberals' Strange Retreat on Government Spending. And the president in addressing the collapsing Black Monday's collapsing cascading stock market crashes around the world, came out and said that we'll always be a AAA nation. And of course, no sooner had he said that than the stock market took its worst tumble in a number of years. I'm wondering, who's doing strategy at the White House?
Are you asking me who's doing strategy?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that was a... He could have come out today and made that statement because the market rebounded, but it looked... But the timing was such that he said, oh, we're doing great, and then...
I don't have much access to the White House these days, to tell you the truth. I think I've written too much critical stuff, so I really can't answer that question. I assume the president makes a lot of decisions.
Well, do you agree that he's taking a beating in terms of, I mean, you've been up there in New Hampshire covering Romney, and what Romney's saying now, his shtick is that I'm the CEO of America Incorporated, and Obama is out of his depth.
I think the president has a pretty good chance of not getting reelected. I don't think that the economy is going to rebound sufficiently by the summer, next summer, to make it possible for him to run a positive campaign. And I think he's going to have a hard time just running a purely negative campaign against the Republicans, unless they nominate somebody from their fringes.
So do you think in part, John Judas, this has to do with him being joined at the hip with the Republicans on this terrible deal that they made in order to stop the extortion over the debt ceiling? And frankly, there's no question that the president bought into that deal. He didn't get what he wanted, but he didn't walk away from the deal.
Well, I think that Barack Obama has one glaring weakness as president, which is that he's averse to conflict with the other side. He's not willing to fight it out, and he's not willing to represent himself as fighting on behalf of the middle class, or the working class, what have you. He's given in at crucial moments to the opposition. And particularly when, as in this case, their demands were really totally unreasonable. So I think that he's weakened his reputation as a leader significantly.
And why do you think that's the case, John Judas? Because all politicians have at least some measure of self-survival, and they're always looking to the next election, and you don't agree to things that are going to basically sink your ship.
Well, I let's go back to the question about conflict. I think that there's two things at play. One is personality and character. I don't think he likes mixing it up. I don't think he likes that kind of politics, vilifying the opposition, demonizing them, representing himself as a force of good against evil. That's the way a lot of politics happens. He doesn't like it. The second factor is I think that he and some of his political advisors have this theory that there are a lot of independents out there who are looking for a kind of good government above it all, a politician who's willing to compromise at every turn. I don't think that's the case. I think there are such people, but I don't think that there are enough of those people to carry a presidential candidate to victory in 2012. So I think it's a combination of political strategy and personality.
But again, since the president has not separated, he's in fact in many ways bought into the Republican narrative. He's tied the economy to the debt when there's no real relationship. And in your essay in the New Republic, John Judas, Liberal Strange Retreat from Government Spending, you're saying that we need to revive that message that is what is in fact needed now. It's not austerity, but we need to be priming the pump during a recession, not turning off the tap. And arguably, what just happened on Wall Street in the last few days and around the world had a lot more less to do with the S&P downgrade and a lot more to do with Wall Street realizing that $2 trillion have been taken out of an anemic economy, and this is only going to deepen the recession.
I have read things to that effect from people on Wall Street that's what they were concerned about, and I'm not surprised. I mean, we're presently on a very dangerous course. There's you can look across the Atlantic Ocean at Great Britain, where Cameron thinks that the best way to solve their problems is through austerity, and he may perhaps be seeing the results of that right now. In the United States, we have a political party that is also bought into that you cut public spending during a recession. This is, you know, we figured this out 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago during the Great Depression. This isn't the way to get out of a downturn. You have to use government at those times to do what the private sector is still reluctant to do, which is to spend, invest, to give people the money to consume. And if you don't do that, you're going to go back down into another recession. And that looks like what we may be doing.
Again, I'm speaking with John Judas, who's a senior editor at the New Republic, where he has an essay, Liberals' Strange Retreat, on government spending. So you mentioned, John, that you're not popular with the White House, and I think you've been a fairly early critic of their tactics. By the way, I spoke the other day with one of Clinton's guys, whose name suddenly slips me because I'm having a senior moment here, his chief strategist, along with Paul Magallo. I can't think of his name. He's married to the Republican woman.
Carville.
There you go. No, thank you, John. Jim Carville. And I asked him about the question that I asked you at the top, which is who's doing strategy at the White House? And he said, Barack Obama's the kind of guy who shows up for a strip poker game wearing Speedos.
Uh-huh.
So tell me, though, your essay is an attempt to suggest that maybe there's a way to, even though it looks like you've said that he may have lost it in 2012 already, but still there's a race to run. What are the chances of him picking up on what you're talking about, which is starting a whole new narrative? Obviously, the American people have bought this deficit Kool-Aid and this mantra from Wall Street that we've got to get our fiscal house in order. And as you've just pointed out, the people on Wall Street know the opposite, which is that the policies of austerity are the ones that are killing the economy and killing off the recovery.
The only way to do it that I can see, and he's had this opportunity now for the last 2 years, is to say that we're in a deep crisis and that he made a mistake in not going far enough, that was what the problem was, and to try to rally the American people to that. I think it's going to be very hard to do it, and I also don't think they are going to do it. I think that they are pretty much resigned to having a lousy economy. There was a story today that I've heard confirmed from other sources that they're already readying this campaign to try to make Romney look bad because they don't want him as the Republican nominee. I just think that's terrible. It's bad politics all around. But that's the direction they're going.
So you were up in New Hampshire yesterday covering Romney. There's a report in the Huffington Post that he blamed the S&P downgrade on Social Security. They quote him here as saying, a nation just can't pay this much back. Did you hear that?
This much referred to debt. I didn't hear him say anything of the kind about Social Security. He was asked about Social Security at another setting yesterday, and he talked about what the different ways might be to prevent the program from becoming insolvent in decades. But they were the kind of things you would hear in Washington, raising the retirement age, things like that. So it's not...
That's the stuff that the White House has already...
That particular quote was not about Social Security.
Right. That's what the White House has already put on the table, so they don't have a case there. So what's your impressions of this guy? If the White House think he's the one that they have to stop, my understanding that it's the Republicans that'll probably stop him in the primaries.
We'll have to see. He's got some advantages of money and organization, and insofar as the economy is the main issue, he's pretty well positioned. There are also a lot of Republican primary states where independents can vote, and where they're more likely to vote in the Republican primary this year because there isn't going to be a competitive Democratic primary. I think his main opposition is going to be Perry, if Perry gets into the race, because Romney is not going to do well in the South. He'll probably have to win Florida, I would think.
It's a pretty foregone conclusion, isn't it, that Perry's going to jump in this week?
Well, yeah, but you never know. I mean, people mm-hmm. foregone conclusion that Mitch Daniels was going to run too. So we'll see.
Well, it's also something of a foregone conclusion that the other Mormon Huntsman was the dark horse, and he seems to be floundering. What's your impression? You were just up there, where he's also campaigning, right?
Who is the dark horse?
Huntsman.
Oh, Huntsman. I think Huntsman is too liberal for the Republican primary electorate. I don't know how much difference there is if you took an X-ray of Huntsman and Romney's brain, but Huntsman has been is too much identified with Obama, and some of his stands are a little too reasonable.
So it's not that he's a bad candidate. He's got unfortunate baggage for the Republican primary voter.
Well, he is a bad candidate.
Oh, okay.
It's not that he would make a bad president, but he's not going to get the chance.
I see. And what about Romney then? Because the critique I've heard is that he has an authenticity problem, that he just doesn't seem like a real person. Did you get any?
He's pretty good in person. We'll have to see. I mean, a lot of the authenticity problem comes from the fact that he's changed his positions markedly on social issues. I actually covered his Senate race against Ted Kennedy for the New Republic, and I was tipped off to cover it by the Log Cabin Republicans, the gay group that said, you know, this is our guy. This is, this is a candidate who really understands our issues. And indeed, in that race, he was very much pro-gay, civil rights, and so I think that's where his authenticity problem comes from.
Right. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, John Judas, but I thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with John Judas, who's a senior editor at The New Republic. His books include The Paradox of American Democracy, Elite Special Interests in the Betrayal of Public Trust, William F. Buckley, Patron Saint of the Conservatives, and Grand Illusion, Critics and Champions of the American Century. He's been covering Mitt Romney's campaign in New Hampshire and has an essay at The New Republic titled, where is it now? Here, yeah. The Liberal Strange Retreat on Government Spending. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? We began talking with Caroline Frost, who's an editor with the Huffington Post UK's edition. She previously was a news producer for BBC News. She joined us for an update on the riots, the fourth day of the riots. Last night, her neighborhood in Ealing was looted, all of the shops in her neighborhood. Many of them, she said, were just small businesses like the local florist, that the looters came from out of town via the subway. And she wasn't particularly impressed by their political statements attacking small businesses, although in the London proper, apparently, the target seemed to have been some of the luxury stores, which is a kind of political protest or statement against the wealthy. She didn't deny that there was a lot of bitterness in England from the young who feel their opportunities are being taken away, and these new austerity measures imposed on them by this new Conservative government are even diminishing their opportunities further, and that this new Conservative government, with 16 multimillionaires in the cabinet, most of them were on vacation in the south of France and Italy, and Cameron, the Prime Minister, had to come back, poor fellow, from his Italian vacation with a sporting a suntan to deal with all of this rioting. So there's no question that there's a political dimension to it, and it is a lot to do with class warfare, but there's also a kind of sense of criminal opportunism and anarchy as well. Then we talked about Syria, trying to figure out whether the resignation of the defense minister and the lecture given to Assad's dictator Assad by the Turkish foreign minister and Saudi Arabia criticizing them, because the Saudi human rights criticism coming from the Saudis has to be taken with a grain of salt. But James Galvin, professor of Middle East history at the UCLA, a specialist on Syria, really sort of, I think, made a pretty strong case, albeit a depressing one, that the, you know, the Americans, the Israelis, nobody really wants this hideous regime to go away. They think that what will replace it will be so much worse, and they're just hoping that somehow these murderous criminals will hold on and that the world will forget what's happened and play along with what this horrible regime that they've been clearly playing along with for some time, including the Israelis, who are very comfortable with the Syrian dictatorship. So a very sad and cynical, but nevertheless, I think, a fairly accurate reading of the situation. And then John Judas from the New Republic joined us. He has an essay out, Liberal Strange Retreat on Government Spending. He thinks Obama is a one-term president, and unless he rallies the liberals and comes up with a new narrative about not the austerity one, but that we need to revive Social Security and Medicare, not cut it, that he's going to go down. And he also covered Mitt Romney and was able to talk to us about how Romney will be a real challenge to the president. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time one night in America.
time one night.